Good evening, folks, and welcome back on this Saturday, the 13th of July. I'm your host, Mark Hall. Let's talk about what's been going on during a very busy and admittedly somewhat disgusting week, especially if you've been paying attention and know just how badly we've been lied to for how long. But at least this week, even the waste-stream media is finally having to admit what those of us who don't rely on them for news have known for at least a decade or more. Very, very bad people doing very bad things have been able to get away with it because of lots and lots of blackmail throughout the highest levels of government, here and abroad. Jeffrey Epstein, Sex Slave Island, and the Lolita Express are really just a symptom of a much bigger problem that, if we step back and look at it, literally ties all of the other criminality together. Now, for a second there, I was tempted to say, hey, let's review this complicated story from the beginning. But then I realized, wait a minute, as long as I've been doing radio, folks, for over two decades ago at this point, doesn't quite take us back all the way to the beginning. But it certainly takes us back well into the Clinton regime, and a whole lot of it started there, and it's just managed to fester ever since. So instead, let's just try starting at the first part of the week. And given what went on over the weekend, I call this introduction Earthquakes and Icebergs.
Maybe the earthquake part is obvious by now. Most people have probably heard about the major pair from a 6.2 or 4, depending upon who you ask, up through a 7.1 that hit Southern California last weekend. Both of those, in that order, were the biggest to hit in 20 years. And at this point, I will make one more observation that's no doubt been made a lot over the last few days. There have been no shortage of predictions for quite a while now about the big one. I'm sure everybody's heard those. Question, of course, is when. Your host has seen no shortage of stories of late about swarms, indicating that something is coming real soon now. The trouble is that earthquake predictions have proven to be, well, over the last couple of years certainly, well, at least, more reliable, of course, than occasional Cortex's warnings about the end of the world because there's not enough socialism. On the other hand, less reliable even than the WAPO talking about the Mueller report. Eventually, it too did come out. But unless you count Democrats quaking in their boots afterwards, it was no more than about a 2.1 on the Richter scale.
The Epstein big one, arguably an even longer time coming, is arguably going to be even bigger, but we'll see.
The trouble, though, with the most recent large California quakes is that experts seem to agree, big as they were, they didn't relieve the stress on the major fault zones, so there may well be more to come. They just still don't have a clue when. Which brings us now to the icebergs. Well, or perhaps better put, what may be the tip of a really big iceberg.
Hopefully.
Even a whole North Atlantic full of them. Here's a summary of the headlines from all kinds of sources. Jeffrey Epstein, perhaps most famous for being a Clinton insider and good bud, has been arrested again for sex trafficking. Of minors, of course. Says even the left-leaning Daily Beast, billionaire pedophile Jeffrey Epstein, was arrested Saturday for allegedly sex trafficking dozens of minors in New York and Florida and perhaps other places, but those are the two named, between 2002 and 2005.
He was in court on Monday.
Epstein, of course, owns not only a New York City mansion, but an island in the Caribbean, a.k.a. Sex Slave Island, and it's serviced, pun intended, by the infamous Lolita Express. And Saturday's arrest, the story continues, by the NYPD FBI Crimes Against Children Task Force, comes 12 years or so after the 66-year-old financier essentially got a friendly slap on the wrist for allegedly molesting dozens of underage girls in Florida. Clearly it helps to be a good buddy of Robert Mueller and company, as opposed to being on his enemies list. For more than a decade, continues the Daily Beast, Epstein's alleged abuse of minors has been the subject of lawsuits brought by victims, investigations by local and federal authorities, for all the good that did, and exposés in the press. But despite the attention cast on his alleged sex crimes, the hedge funder has managed to avoid any meaningful jail time, let alone federal charges. And dare I say, folks, that a lot of us have a pretty good idea by now exactly why. We've probably heard the next part before, but here goes.
The latest, but we've heard it all before, indictment accuses Epstein of sexual abuse of lots and lots of underage girls.
paying them with cash for massages, then molesting or sexually abusing them in his Upper East Side mansion or his palatial residence in Palm Beach. And Epstein will be charged with one count of sex trafficking of minors and one count of conspiracy to engage in sex trafficking of minors, which could put him away for a maximum of 45 years, or maybe even a real wrist slap this time, who knows. The case is being handled by the Public Corruption Unit, SICK, of the Southern District of New York, with assistance from the district's human trafficking officials and the federal bunglers of investigations. Hey folks, is it just possible that they might finally decide to do something right and try to start reversing that oh-so-apropos moniker? We'll see. The girls were as young as 14. Epstein knew they were underage, yada, 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 according to all the documents involved. Said attorney David Boies, who represents Epstein accusers Virginia Roberts Joffrey and Sarah Ransom, "It's been a long time coming. It's been too long coming. And it's an important step towards getting justice for the many victims of Mr. Epstein's sex trafficking enterprise. We hope that prosecutors will not stop with Mr. Epstein." And there, folks, is the tip of that proverbial iceberg. Because there were many other people who participated with him and made the sex trafficking possible. Unquote, he told the Daily Beast.
And by Friday, say follow-up stories, including the Miami Herald, at least four women have already contacted attorney David Boies, who represents some of Epstein's victims, and at least 10 others have approached other lawyers who previously represented other victims. In other words, they're coming out of the woodwork now that, at least as the headline claims, they have no fear, or maybe they have less fear than they did for years and years. Who knows? Maybe they're even starting to get optimistic again that somebody will actually listen to them and even do something this time. But again, I keep having to say, we'll see.
Now, here, folks, is where the story really starts to get murky, because literally all of the connections in here and the connections to the connections almost read like a who's who of the deep state swamp, both in the United States and literally all over the world.
As the week went on, more and more ink was spilled, or digital ink anyway, not only about his dozens and dozens of victims, but high-profile politicians who once knew him and no longer seem to want to.
The alternative press has been well aware of the Epstein case for a long, long time now, but the Daily Beast seems to think it didn't really matter until the Miami Herald published a three-part series on how his wealth, power, and influence shielded him from federal prosecution for years.
And that, too, folks, is just the bare tip of the iceberg.
Noting that while the Me Too movement toppled other really powerful men, Epstein's name was largely absent from the national conversation until a mainstream giant stepped up to the plate. The Daily Beast, though, says they are among those who've talked for years about Epstein's alleged abuse, starting with Conchita Sarnoff's expose on his easy jail sentence and soft treatment by the U.S. Attorney's Office, which ultimately scrapped a 53-page indictment against Epstein. And earlier versions of Epstein's plea included a 10-year federal sentence before his star-studded lawyer threatened to go to trial in a case prosecutors feared was unwinnable. No, folks, what they really feared was that there were a whole lot of other names that might come out, and that was to be avoided at all costs. But the Daily Beast seems to kind of soft-pedal that, saying instead it was, well, at least in part, because Epstein's team managed to dredge up dirt on the victims, including their past drug use. They do, though, talk about his sweetheart deal, where Epstein dodged federal charges that, had he not been arguably such a good friend of Bill, would have sent him to prison for life. And his latest bust comes mere months after a federal judge ruled that his 2007 NPA, or non-prosecution agreement, secretly inked under former U.S. attorney, deep state insider, and current labor secretary Alexander Acosta,
oops, well, wait a second on that one,
violated federal law, since when does that matter, by keeping Epstein's victims in the dark. The alleged victim, says the story, sued the government for violating the Crime Victims' Rights Act and have asked the court to rescind Epstein's NPA, calling for the feds to actually hold him criminally liable, along with his co-conspirators who were also granted immunity in the document. And yes, folks, please contain your surprise. And there's this, too. The NPA granted immunity to any, quote, potential co-conspirator of Epstein's and ensured that the deal would, quote, not be made part of any public record, unquote. Said attorney Paul Cassell, who represents a number of those victims in their lawsuit against the federal government, if today's report is true, it only proves that Epstein should have been charged by federal prosecutors, 12 years ago in Florida. With his money, Epstein was able to buy more than a decade of delay in facing justice, but unfortunately, he wasn't able to postpone justice forever, unquote. And I guess we'll see what we see. Far more importantly, folks, will it be the rest of the iceberg?
Oh, and by Friday, we did have this update. Labor Secretary Alexander Acosta, yeah, that guy, announced his resignation after receiving, to put it mildly, harsh criticism for his role in brokering that now infamous 2008 plea deal with registered sex offender and pedophile Jeffrey Epstein. He said it was his idea. He let the president know Friday morning, and good riddance. Now, as I said before, folks, there's page after page after page of allegation and documentation in these various reports, not to mention lots and lots of high-profile denials from Alan Dershowitz to the former rapist-in-chief, I did not have sex with those little girls, to Prince Andrew and Buckingham Palace. The one that's pretty much representative and certainly informative comes from accuser Virginia Roberts Jeffrey, who's long claimed that Epstein and his paramour at the time, Ghislaine Maxwell, famous British socialite, wealthy youngest child of publisher Robert Maxwell, not to mention lots of other connections, from the rumored to the outright conspiratorial, abused minor girls all over the country and indeed all over the world, and that included her from the age of 15, while Epstein loaned his victims out to his famous friends, including the aforementioned Dershowitz and Prince Andrew. The court filing says the story includes a photo of Andy putting his arm around Jeffrey's partially bare waist while Maxwell smiles in the background. Another high-profile insider named is Jean-Luc Brunel, who runs the MC2 modeling agency and is said to have supplied Epstein with girls as young as 12. Quote, Jeffrey Epstein has told me he slept with over 1,000 of Brunel's girls, and everything I've seen confirms this data, she said. Claiming that she herself finally escaped Epstein's abuse when he sent her to Thailand to learn Thai massage and to recruit another young girl for his alleged sex ring, where she was able to meet her future husband and then relocated to Australia. It's her follow-ups, though, over the years with the federal bunglers of investigations and others, which might be most interesting. She said in 2014 she tried to contact the FBI for an update. They seemed to have been blocked from doing what was right, and said in her declaration, quote, I have never been able to figure out who was and still is stopping a prosecution. Because nothing is being done, she added, it makes me think that Epstein was right when he told me he had so many people in his pocket. Maybe those people are still helping him to escape being prosecuted for what he did against me. The justice system, she continued, doesn't seem to respond to the victims in this case. It seems to favor those who have the most money and power and influence, unquote, and gee, there's a real shocker, especially when we're talking about this kind of money, power, and influence. And let's not forget, perhaps most importantly, blackmail ability. So onto the iceberg itself, courtesy of a Forbes piece entitled Jeffrey Epstein Documents Could Expose Powerful Politicians and Businessmen, after a court ruled that the public's right to access case information outweighed the privacy of certain, one could almost, but maybe not quite anymore, insert the words, above-the-law individuals. Last week, a federal appeals court ordered that 167 documents in a lawsuit alleging famously well-connected financier Jeffrey Epstein participated in his sex trafficking ring should be unsealed, and that many of his powerful friends could actually be named. In his 27-page decision, the court said the public's right to access to case information outweighed the privacy of certain individuals, quote, including prominent American politicians, powerful business executives, foreign presidents, a well-known prime minister, and other world leaders, unquote. And the lawsuit here that we're referring to is that one from Virginia Jeffrey, now Roberts, against Ghislaine Maxwell, alleging she'd been used as part of that sex trafficking network of underage girls to Epstein and a whole bunch of his famous buds. Still, though, there's caution to be advised. The court urges the public to read such accounts with discernment and warned that the documents wouldn't be immediately available anyway because anonymous individuals in the case still have at least 2 weeks to file appeals or do whatever else they may do behind closed doors to make sure the public never does really have a right to know. Now, folks, at this point, I will pause and note that in all of those stories that I've just referenced, from the Daily Beast to Forbes, there wasn't one mention, at least not in any scandalous sense, of a former U.S. president or even a current one. But they're both kind of the elephant in the room. And as the week went on, the spin got more and more obvious. You knew where it was going to go, didn't you? The closest the Daily Beast gets to implying anything untoward was that Epstein, who's billed himself as a renowned philanthropist, has palled around with a lot of famous faces, including Donald Trump and Bill Clinton. Clinton, they say, quote, traveled with Epstein to Africa to address issues like economic development and AIDS, unquote. And as congressional documents are known to say, for other purposes. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Hey, turns out that Kevin Spacey was on board the Lolita Express for that trip, too. Imagine. The Business Insider, among many no doubt seeking to focus the attention of the public where it belongs, on Donald Trump's connections as opposed to, well, Bill and Hill's connections, early in the week had a banner headline trumpeting that Trump once praised the billionaire charged with sex trafficking of minors for liking women, quote, on the younger side. And they even have a big glossy picture of a much younger Donald and now Melania Trump. At the time, it was his girlfriend, model Melania Knaus, with the financier Epstein and his British socialite girlfriend at the time, Ghislaine Maxwell, at none other than the Mar-a-Lago Club in Palm Beach, Florida, dated February 12th of 2000. And gee, folks, can't tell you how many times I saw that photo this week. In light of weekend events, say the waste stream sources, a quote from Donald Trump praising the billionaire's fondness for young women has resurfaced. It's Trump biographer Tim O'Brien who tweeted the quote from a 2002 profile of Epstein for New York Magazine in which Trump says, I've known Jeff for 15 years. Terrific guy. He's a lot of fun to be with. It's even said that he likes beautiful women as much as I do, and many of them are on the younger side. Unquote. Funny, too, how most references that I found in the waste stream to anything associated with the Clintons made sure to mention that he was also good buddies with Trump and that Bill took that famous trip with him to Africa, but not so much about the evidently more than 20 other trips on the infamous private jet nicknamed the Lolita Express to Epstein's sex slave island. By Tuesday, honest Bill Clinton was already lying up a storm and getting called out for it, too. Not so much, of course, by the criminally negligent networks and his accomplices, but by the alternative press, anyway. Sundance at the Conservative Treehouse summarized it this way. Investigative reporter Conchita Sarnoff has spent over a decade looking at documents and talking to officials and witnesses in and around the Jeffrey Epstein case. She authored the book called Trafficking and joined Fox News host Shannon Bream on Monday night to discuss the background of the Epstein child sex slave trafficking case. When asked about Bill Clinton's overnight denial, because he only traveled with Mr. Epstein four times, Sarnoff flat out called the former president and unindicted but much alleged rapist a liar, based on known documentary evidence, flight logs, and witness accounts.
And I know from the pilot logs, and these are pilot logs that, you know, were written by different pilots and at different times, that Clinton went, he was a guest of Epstein's 27 times. Now you tell me, Doug Banz was also on the plane many times. Many of those times Clinton had his Secret Service with him, and many times he did not. Almost every time that Clinton's name is on the pilot logs, there are underage girls. There are initials, and there are names of many, many girls on that private plane.
And she goes on to ask some of the obvious questions. Basically, what's anyone, let alone a former president, doing that often, especially without a Secret Service, on the Lolita Express? So the interviewer pointed out that the former prevaricator-in-chief may be doing it again, and she asked Sarnoff pretty much point-blank, are you calling this guy? The man whose name is synonymous with lying, or at least in the Clintonian style.
It all depends on what the meaning of the word is.
Yeah, are you calling honest Bill a liar?
Yes, I am saying, sadly, that he is not telling the truth. First of all, Gerald Lefcourt, who was one of Epstein's attorneys back during the original arrest and the original investigation, wrote a letter, which is it has been made public. And in that letter, Gerald Lefcourt claims that Epstein was one of the original funders, mm-hmm. of the Clinton Global Initiative. He gave Jeffrey Epstein gave President Clinton $4 million, according to a source who knows a story about that.
So I guess the bottom line is, yeah, folks, in this case, unlike Monica Lewinsky, a blue dress, and all kinds of other peccadilloes in and around and before and after the White House, Paula Jones, Juanita Broderick, Kathleen Willey, and lots of others that were evidently taken care of by Hitler's infamous bimbo eruption squad, it's not just about sex or even just about lying. There's lots of money involved, too. Gee, who could have thought it? Ann Coulter, in an interview with KABC, outlined what's perhaps obvious, that Epstein had a state sponsor backing him and that his operation was all about blackmail. Referring to the accounts of some of his girls, she said, quote, he wanted them to have sex with powerful men, come back to him and report on it, describe what they wanted, what their fetishes were, and he had cameras throughout the house, so this was obviously for blackmailing purposes, said Ann Coulter. It just seems to me something much bigger is behind this. Perhaps a state sponsor, powerful enough people. It just seems to me there's a very powerful force behind what's going on here, and I'm still nervous about this not coming to a conclusion. Somehow, this getting compromised, unquote. And given what we already know about the animus and the obviously continuing witch hunt here, directed at anything and anyone who would oppose the deep state, I do have to ask again, is the deep state and left so intent on destroying Donald Trump utterly and by any means necessary that they're more than willing to perform a human sacrifice of at least one and possibly more of their former heroes in order to get her done? It certainly looks like that, more and more. But let's make this clear, too. That doesn't mean we're actually going to hear the whole truth here. Meanwhile, though, most of the way stream seems intent on making this all about Donald Trump's connection to the bad guy, not honest bills. The Fox story says records showed that Trump apparently flew on the jet at least once, but this story at least does note that Trump banned Epstein from his Mar-a-Lago estate because, quote, Epstein sexually assaulted an underage girl at the club, according to court documents filed by Bradley Edwards, lawyer who's represented a number of Epstein accusers. From here, it's time to return to the why of all of this. If you have enough really, really nasty dirt on enough very powerful people, you can blackmail almost anybody and evidently get away with it. And since it's getting to be pretty obvious, let's set this up with a thought experiment. Just suppose you had enough people who were powerful enough to get nice, incriminating, well, photographs and videotapes. Some of them are no doubt digital by now. Of all kinds of wannabe deep state officials, senators, presidents, high-level bureaucrats, probably FBI, and all kinds of other three-letter agency top criminals, you name it. But we're speculating here, right? Because we're probably never going to hear the actual details. Hopefully we remember how Anthony Weiner's laptop managed to disappear. Do you think there's a lot of motivation to cover it up? Well, that's obvious. We've seen it. Or even silence by any means necessary. Anybody that might want to blow the whistle on this one? Oh, yeah. After all, it was merely a conspiracy theory for years and years before it became undeniably in your face. You can't hide it anymore. But so, what are we going to do about it instead?
But that's not what's worrying me. It's how to do it. These things must be done delicately, or you hurt the stare.
I know, and we're not the only ones to be considering this. Given that the Mueller investigation, sick, a.k.a. witch hunt, was such a total flop and didn't achieve the desired goal, by any means necessary, getting rid of President Donald Trump, maybe we can use the radioactivity surrounding Jeffrey Epstein to nail the guy. Oh, and who better to participate than the daughter of none other than the whoremeister himself, James Comey. After all, the appearance of impropriety or bias doesn't mean squat anymore, and the stench of the deep state so completely surrounds everything here that, why not? Maureen Comey, assistant U.S. attorney, was named alongside a couple of other shills as the prosecutors assisting with the Epstein, well, I guess I ought to say it this way in honor of the whoremeister, the Epstein matter. But wait, there's more. Are you ready for this? And talking about deja vu, Attorney General William Barr himself, like Jeff Sessions before him, has recused himself from the Epstein matter because one of the firms he worked for a long time ago once represented the guy. And we're supposed to believe now they're concerned about appearances of conflict of interest? Why don't they just bring back Peter Strzok to help out while they're at it? And as disgusting as that might be, especially if the only real goal here is, by any means necessary, to get rid of, once and for all, Donald J. Trump and anybody and everybody that actually believes we still have a constitution in this once free land, it almost seems at this point like they're willing to offer up a sacrificial William Jefferson Blythe Clinton, or even the Clinton legacy, such as it is, in order to accomplish it. How's that for playing 3D chess and the Queen's Gambit? Which is why we may never see the entire iceberg, folks, but at least the glimpses we get should be interesting. Welcome back now to the second segment for this evening. This is still your host, Mark Hall. And in the first segment, we talk primarily about what I've been calling the iceberg story. Are we ever even going to see 10%? Concerning Jeffrey Epstein, Sex Slave Island, the Lolita Express, and all the sex trafficking and pedophilia and stuff that we've known about for years that's been ignored for even longer, and is arguably the biggest deep state blackmail and control story in U.S. history. And if history is any guide, probably won't turn out any different this time, other than the usual political expediency, than it ever has. So we didn't yet touch on one of the other biggest stories of the week that's also been building for a long time, and is pretty much an iceberg as well. I'm talking about the German Deutsche Bank, which for a long, long time, most of the Austrian economists that your host respects have been pointing out is the canary in the coal mine. When it finally and inevitably goes belly up, lots and lots of stuff will follow, and it looks like that's happened. But to some extent, kind of like California and the big one, what we saw with Deutsche Bank is still about a 7.1 earthquake, with no doubt more to follow. Let's go with the Waystream talking head summary first, via CNBC. Deutsche Bank announced sweeping reforms, which also involve the creation of a 74 billion euro or $83 billion so-called bad bank, which is where they dump the toxic stuff, to cost 7.4 billion euros by 2022. They expect a net second quarter loss due out around the end of July of 2.8 billion euros. In the ever-optimistic bid to improve profitability, the bank is going to cut 18,000 jobs over the next couple of years and close its global equity sales and trading business. And the moves, often greeted with remarks to the effect that it's about time, come just 2 days after its investment banking chief Garth Ritchie stepped down by mutual agreement. We turn to Tyler Durden and Zero Hedge, however, for their Tuesday morning update for a bit more of the real story. The mood is pretty hopeless, says their headline. Scenes outside Deutsche Bank offices evoke Lehman collapse. And at the end of the day, they begin all the frenzied whispers in the press about Deutsche Bank CEO Christian Sewing's sweeping restructuring hardly did it justice. Instead of moving slowly, the bank started herding hundreds of employees into meetings with HR, first in its offices in Asia, Hong Kong and Sydney, then London, which got hit particularly hard, and then finally New York City. And by some accounts, it was the largest mass banker firing since the collapse of Lehman Brothers, which left nearly 30,000 employees in New York City jobless. Although the American economy is at least allegedly doing comparatively well relative to Europe, across the world, DB employees might struggle to find work again in their same field, especially at their average $1.25 million annual salary. Because, you know, things like automation. And let's not forget the fiat meltdown, the biggest debt bubble in human history, oh, and the biggest worldwide derivatives bubble, too. They recapped Sewing's grand restructuring plan, which involved shutting down the entire loss-making global equity business, cutting 18,000 jobs, or about one-fifth of the bank's total headcount, and hiving off almost a third of $1 trillion of loss-making assets into that bad bank for sale or runoff. And if you're wondering who would buy such a thing, well, sometimes you just have to chuckle a little bit and say, take a look at history and then take a guess. The goal of the restructuring, it said, is to reorient DB away from its troubled institutional business and more toward commercial banking and asset management.
So for now, at least, let's summarize things with a bit of an analogy. We had swarms of mini-earthquakes leading up to this, and now we've had a reasonably big one, but it doesn't look at all yet like the tectonic stresses have been relieved. So expect more to follow.
The timing of all these announcements, even though the Lolita Express big one happened just before the weekend, as we're getting used to, in conjunction with recent big moves up in gold and bankster bombshells like Deutsche Bank that, even though they've been a long time coming, are finally really here, are probably no coincidence. In spite of the tremors, the really big earthquake has been on the horizon for over a decade now. So let's take a look at some of the underlying economic stories to help make that point. China, says a piece from Zero Hedge, officially has bought gold now for the seventh straight month as treasury holdings in the United States continue to tumble. In May, they added another 10 tons of the precious metal to the reserve. And again, that's the seventh month of buying in a row, said Bart Melek, global head of commodity strategy at TD Securities. It's a diversification away from the U.S. dollar, particularly given the trade tensions and the potential technology cold war that's evolving. We do have to remember, he said, that gold is nobody's liability. And what's interesting is that even though this figure is hotly contested, most consider it to be an underestimate of the actual Chinese state gold holdings. It's the only figure available, and whatever the real number is, it's now notable that the Chinese government has revived the trend of actually announcing their physical gold purchases each and every month. Maybe there's a message there. There's another message here, though, from Poland, which has joined Hungary not only with a huge gold purchase, but with a demand for repatriation. Last October, says a piece from the Daily Coin and Bullion Star, Hungary's central bank announced that after 32 years of holding unchanged gold reserves, it had begun rapidly increasing its monetary gold holdings by tenfold or 1,000%, up to almost 32 tons, and also repatriated or brought home the entire holding that they formerly kept in London to Budapest, away from the clutches of the Bank of England. How long, they asked then, until somebody else follows suit? Answer, not long at all, because now we can add Hungary's neighbor and closest political ally, Poland, which has just in its own way shocked the gold market and the European Union by announcing that during the first half of the year 2019, they too had bought nearly 100 tons of monetary gold, bringing their gold holdings, still at the Bank of England, up to almost 230 tons, but now they too plan to repatriate about half of that to the National Bank of Poland vaults in Warsaw. Evidently, folks, nothing really says, I don't trust you, like, give me my gold. And from there, two sets of observations from two well-known gold market analysts. First, Clint Sener, via GoldEagle.com, who notes that the continued manipulation schemes by the bullion banksters put taxpayers at risk. Gee, there's a shocker. But he starts out this way. Gold and silver bugs are well aware that J.P. Morgan Chase dominates precious metals futures trading, leading Pam and Russ Martins of the financial blog Wall Street on Parade to identify just how much control they really have, noting that there are more than 5,300 FDIC-insured banks in the United States, but just two of them, J.P. Morgan and Citibank, hold over 75%, that's three-quarters plus, of all precious metals derivatives contracts, primarily futures, in possession of the entire set of the nation's banks. Other Wall Street banksters, including Goldman Sachs and the Bank of America, are barely even in the game. And that market dominance implied by the outside positions of these two banksters might be troubling enough, because metals investors, as some of you probably know, have been pleading with so-called regulators, yeah sure, to step in for more than a decade, and obviously, so far, to no avail. But what's interesting, they say, isn't just the monopoly power these banks wielded and still wield. That's been pretty well understood for years now. But it's the massive increase of late in the size of the position that's occurred since the 2008 financial crisis and arguably beginning of the Greater Depression. 10 years ago, FDIC-insured banks held metals contracts valued at less than $15 billion. Today, the number amounts to almost $39 billion fiat bucks, an increase of almost 160%. One more confirmation that the futures markets for paper, gold, and silver are hopelessly broken and corrupted. Price discovery is not organic, they say, it's simply rigged, and so-called regulators have turned a blind eye to the corruption for years. But wait, there's more, because all of this activity isn't just crooked, it's exceptionally risky, says Sener. These banks are, in fact, FDIC insured, and since FDIC funds may or probably won't be sufficient in the event of a major collapse. Taxpayers could, and almost certainly will, folks, end up footing the bill in more ways than one. Especially, note sooner, now that the central banksters and the regulators that are supposed to regulate them seem to be finally losing control. Bill Holter at JS Mindset, though, starts at that point and moves on. We've been trying to point out for quite a few years, he says, just how bogus the financial reporting has been. Few listened because the markets, quote, proved us wrong. But as time went on and the economic and financial reporting got more and more bogus and further from the truth, to the point that even young children had questions, we're there. Actions are finally speaking volumes louder than words. For example, even some of the waste stream is finally asking, if the economy is so stinking good, why does the Fed need to lower rates? And we've been hearing for years how the Fed would normalize rates. There was no real problem, even though we said otherwise. Last fall, the Fed raised rates 3 times, which led to a near meltdown. Then they caved and decided to go the other direction. And here we are. The Fed is facing their greatest fear, the dreaded liquidity trap. And let's look at some recent specifics. Does anyone, asked Bill Holter, really believe Deutsche Bank is less important or smaller than a Lehman Brothers? Can you say $50 trillion plus worth of derivatives? Or how about Apple? A 42% drop in sales to India's 1 billion person population? Does that mean anything at all? Do the recent revelations that two Facebook, Gulag, YouTube, Twitter, etc. about gathering and selling data and, of course, making and taking political stances, First Amendment et al. Be damned? Does that have any bearing on anything? And Boeing? Have they sold a single plane in recent months? Maybe we should mention Greece, too, selling new bonds at all-time low yields. I mean, really, how great is their credit? The point I'm trying to make, says Holter, is that our entire lives are surrounded and engulfed in nothing but lies, which is extremely dangerous when you realize the world economic system is held in place by nothing but confidence and confidence alone. 50 years ago, we had gold at its foundation, even though paper was outstripping the amounts of gold held. Now we're at the point where 300 or more paper gold ounces have been sold for every real ounce in existence. Is that Twilight Zone stuff or what? Confidence has always been paramount in order to keep Ponzi schemes going. But the Ponzi scheme really shifted into high gear come August 15th of 1971, the day Tricky Dick Nixon defaulted on the U.S. dollar to the rest of the world. And it's almost funny now that Deutsche Bank has reintroduced the word bad bank into circulation, because that's exactly what the entire world system has been, and pretty soon they're going to wake up to it. And here, folks, is where so many of the dots that have been revealed this week, even if we've really seen all of them before, begin to connect together. And it emphasizes again just how much there is that Big Brother and his ministries of truth, the public-private partners, simply don't want you to know, understand, or even be allowed to talk about. Some of it, as we've seen, is merely about enslaving you. Others might work even faster, because what you don't know, or aren't allowed to, can in fact kill you. Let me start the sequence with one more brief Epstein reminder from this week. Wikipedia got caught editing Epstein's bio in their so-called encyclopedia pages to remove any references to Bill Clinton. And once that, of course, became big news itself, we better put it back. Then we'll expunge the fact that we ever tried to get away with that from the history books, too. From the much-banned Natural News, and Ethan Huff in this case, Vimeo, one of the few alternatives to Big Gulag's YouTube, not to be left out, is purging all vaccine awareness from its lineup, too, as part of a coordinated tech censorship sweep. That's why the proper term, folks, isn't monopoly, it's cartel. Vimeo says the story has now begun to censor channels and pull content that expresses any type of skepticism about the so-called safety and effectiveness of vaccines. It's gotten to the point, folks, where even if you don't say that it's 100% safe and effective in every case whatsoever, they'll ban you. Joining in on Big Tech's anti-First Amendment fray, says Huff, Vimeo recently announced they'll no longer allow people to, quote, use our platform to spread hateful ideologies. And that includes any of the following, quote, content that falsely claims mass tragedies are hoaxes, or content that depicts or encourages self-harm, and they define what that means, obviously,
or content that perpetuates false or misleading claims about vaccine safety. And obviously, ditto. Although in this case, it might be that Big Pharma has their hand on the scales too. According to video, any viewpoints or opinions that don't include full and unquestioning acceptance of whatever Big Brother claims is true about vaccines can, quote, cause material real-world harms, and thus must be banned from Vimeo in order to protect the public from having informed views. Said Michael Cheat, and I'm not sure if that's a typo or not, Vimeo's general counsel, quote, content that falsely claims that vaccines are unsafe is at the forefront of an unfolding public health crisis. And Big Brother's Big Tech Big Lawyer further warns that Vimeo users with this type of offensive content on what they thought was their channels, they've got just 30 days to remove it all. Otherwise, Octoon, you will be purged. And in case you've forgotten, this follows on the heels of Vimeo having also banned the latest Project Veritas expose about Gulag's conspiracy to rig the upcoming 2020 presidential election in favor of, well, their socialist good buddies. Mike Adams, recently banned from all of these platforms, is now increasingly vocal about the fact that what we're seeing here is large-scale criminal racketeering and fraud implemented by big tech in the name of silencing all independent voices and anything they don't want the generally dumbed-down public, and they're working hard on that, to be allowed to hear or even think. Said Adams, quote, humanity will never be free as long as these tech tyrants are allowed to run roughshod over basic human rights and civil liberties. And therefore, he said, it's time for the CEOs of these tech giants to be arrested and criminally prosecuted for their coordinated criminal collusion and fraud, unquote. Some of his folks, like your host, have even suggested that what's really called for here, not that we're going to see it, would be a congressional declaration of war against probably the biggest enemies that the Republic has ever seen. And yeah, I'm including the other Nazis from the World War II era, who, as Joseph Goebbels would probably admit, when it comes to truly high-tech propaganda, couldn't hold a candle to these guys. But on that score, we're not done yet. From PJ Media, while they still can, Mark Zuckerberg, CEO of Two Facebook itself, has now bragged at this year's Aspen Ideas Festival that Facebook is increasingly trying to work with Big Brother around the world to determine what type of political speech it does and does not allow. Oh, or what ads they're willing to approve. And Michael Vandergalian's story notes, he brags that they didn't even allow pro-life groups to advertise before Ireland's big abortion vote. Zuckerberg specifically cited the 2018 example where American pro-life groups wanted to run advertisements for Facebook users in Ireland because the Irish were about to vote on a referendum concerning abortion legalization. And when Facebook saw the ad request, the company contacted the Irish government asking whether they should or shouldn't allow them. And the response at the time, he said, was, quote, we don't currently have a law, so you need to make whatever decision you want to make, unquote. And since Facebook could do as they please, guess what they did? Quote, we ended up not allowing the ads. Exactly, folks, as we already would have expected. And given all of this, it's no surprise, perhaps, that abortion activists tweeted about how Facebook's COO, Sheryl Sandberg, donated $2 million to Planned Parenthood. So one more time, it's obvious that some ads, some donations, some speech, and some people are simply more equal than others. Apple co-founder Steve Wozniak has finally figured out that Two Facebook really is evil. He deleted his Facebook account last year and, says a piece from Tyler Durden of Zero Hedge, is now telling anyone willing to listen to do the very same while they still can before it's too late. TMZ interviewed Wozniak at Reagan National Airport in D.C. last Friday and asked him if he's troubled by Two Facebook, Instagram, and other socialist media platforms infringing on his privacy. The Woz responded by saying that social platforms are eavesdropping on our private conversations, sending personal data to advertisers and the like, and with a total lack of privacy on socialist media, he said, most people should simply delete their accounts. There are many different kinds of people, he said. For some, the benefits of Facebook are worth the loss of privacy. But to many, like myself, my recommendation is, to most people, you should figure out a way to get off Facebook. In spite of that, he went on to say, basically, when it comes to big tech intrusions and the total destruction of all privacy, there's almost no way to stop it.
I mean, they can measure your heartbeat with lasers, he said. They can listen to you with a lot of devices. Who knows, he asked, if my cell phone's listening right now. Answer is, we do know. It's almost like the only people who can really count on privacy, at least up until the point where Epstein sings like a canary, is to ride the Lolita Express to Orgy Island and have sex with little boys and little girls. Because, you know, big media and big tech will work together to keep all of that under wraps. Socialist media website Twitter has suspended one of the most prominent, articulate, and effective gun rights activists and researchers in the entire world, John R. Lott Jr., over a tweet about that massively overreported New Zealand mass murder. Because, oops, in all of that overreporting, he points out something that they didn't want known. Here's the tweet, folks. New Zealand killer's manifesto said he did the attack to get more gun control and gun bans in New Zealand and the United States. The killer was a socialist environmentalist who hated capitalists and trade. All of which is, of course, true. And he quotes some links that you're not supposed to see. Lott, of course, is founder and president of the Crime Prevention Research Center and the author of 9 books, including some of the best ever written if you really want to know the facts about self-defense, gun control, and crime, which is almost certainly why they hate him so much. One, the most famous perhaps, was called More Guns, Less Crime, and others include The Bias Against Guns and Freedomnomics. Since the oh-so-offensive tweet was almost 4 months old, notes the story, it's almost certain that Google locked Lott's account manually, so perhaps it's part of this latest pogrom. Twitter demands, of course, that Lott delete the offensive post, but he told Ammoland, who reported the story along with Zero Hedge and others, that removing that tweet is simply not something he's willing to consider, especially since Twitter isn't willing to tell anybody exactly what it was about his tweet that was so offensive. Instead, he's urging people to reach out to Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey and Twitter's so-called support. Let them know what they think about him. Ammoland says they tried that, but thus far Twitter has failed to respond to their questions. And I can't help but think it, folks. As Gomer Pyle would say, surprise, surprise, surprise! Which brings me to one last story on this thread. Courtesy of the also much banned, and as it turns out, also much death-threaded, Paul Joseph Watson, who writes that Facebook has issued a new policy update saying it's acceptable to post death threats and incite violence against the likes of him, despite this being a crime in the United Kingdom. And no, he says, I'm not joking. A community standards update published by Two Facebook states, and he puts his own emphasis on it, do not post threats that could lead to death and other forms of high severity violence of any targets where the threat is defined as any of the following, blah blah blah, and then they go on to say, well, unless the target is an organization or individual covered in the dangerous individuals and organizations policy, and they have explicitly named Paul Joseph Watson as one of those dangerous individuals. Ergo, it's okay to death threat him, says Two Facebook. And to make his point, Paul Joseph Watson actually includes screenshot after screenshot of both the community standards pages, as well as literally death threat after death threat he's been getting. One of them, he says, and I can't even begin to quote it, Watson actually had to remove what he called the dumbass's name and address, as well as his place of work. On that one, he added, when you send me death threats, here's a tip, don't leave your name, place of work, and address in the message. He includes another screenshot of violent threats that he says he's received within just the past 24 hours, and it looks like there's over 24 of them from Black Lives Matter supporters alone. And here he adds that the only group he gets more death threats from than Islamists is hashtag Black Lives Matter. It's clearly not peaceful. Yeah, and it's obviously clearly not banned either. Oh, and in case you're curious on this score, Watson has been banned by most of the major socialist media platforms, proving it's not really vitriol or violence that these socialist platforms care about, it's effectiveness. And just in case big tech manages to completely expunge everything associated with Alex Jones, like NewsWars, InfoWars, Prison Planet, and the like, as well as all of their Twitter and YouTube accounts, Watson now has his own news website. It's called Summit.News. And that reminds me, last week, visiting pundit from Italy, Leo Zagami, stopped by the InfoWars headquarters in Austin, had a picture taken of himself with Alex Jones, and was promptly banned from socialist media. So, no, folks, they're not kidding. From the local CBS affiliate in Philadelphia, Philly police have released surveillance video showing dozens of teens vandalizing and stealing from a South Street Walgreens on the 4th of July. Socialist media would no doubt ban you for describing their racial characteristics, which tells you something anyway. But surveillance cameras show about 60 boys and girls storming into the Walgreens around 10 p.m., running around, knocking items off the shelves. They also hit a 46-year-old man over the head with a bottle, injuring him, and then fleeing the store, of course, without paying for the merchandise. Just like that big Wisconsin mob last week that knocked off a North Face store. Did they coordinate the attack via socialist media? Did they tweet about it afterwards? Well, rest assured, they probably won't get banned. But I guess, folks, I am willing to go out on a limb here and predict two things. We'll see more of exactly this kind of attack, and more good people will be banned from bad socialist media for telling the truth about it. Especially if they try to connect forbidden dots.